Hey there, my name's Jared Holt, and welcome back to Posting Through It, your favorite bi-weekly podcast, released every other Monday, or in this case, a little off schedule. You can find the episode archive on postingthroughit.com, and for $5 a month, I'd hope you consider contributing to help keep this project going. There's a newsletter there you can sign up for, and that goes out in between episodes, so you can get your fix even when you're waiting on the next one. I thought the first episode of this year would be the annual call-in episode that I usually do. I don't know what it was about this year, but I got back a whole lot of nothing, or not nothing, but not enough to really do a full episode with it. I got some calls, I got a couple questions, and I'll answer them at the end of the next episode I record. But if you'd like to get your call in the mix, you can dial 202-630-0580. That's 202-630-0580. You'll get a voicemail inbox. It has the old name, the Shitpost podcast name. After the tone, record your message. It can be a question, a joke, whatever you like. Again, I'll play those and respond to them at the end of the next episode I tape. Or if you all surprise me and flood the inbox and I get a ton of them, maybe I'll do a standalone episode with that. But for now, let's get on to it. I've got a great interview for you all today with a couple researchers that worked on the January 6th committee. They were taking a look at extremism, social media, how it all interacted. I think you'll really enjoy this conversation.
A rebel who was searching for treasures in his soul, fishing for gold. I found a key to unlock the door to my mind's gate, hidden with some hieroglyphs. Told me about my future and my past, and that I should get to light work it and get up off my.
Let's get on to it. Megan Conroy and Alex Newhouse are two people who worked on the select committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. That will never not be a mouthful to me. Megan, Alex, how are you doing?
We are doing so well. Thank you for having us, Jared.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So first, I'd love for you two to introduce yourselves to the audience. Who are you? What do you do? How did you get involved in the purple team of the committee? What does that mean, the purple team of the committee? Megan, let's start with you.
Sure. So my name is Megan Conroy, as discussed. I was an investigator when I was on the committee, and now I am a research fellow with DFR Lab. And I'll let Alex introduce himself before I dive into the purple team stuff.
Yeah, I'm Alex. Megan dragged me along onto the committee as a consultant on data analysis and extremism in particular. My day job is that I'm the deputy director of the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at Middlebury. I'm a specialist in far-right extremism, specifically online, and am also a data scientist.
So the purple team, this is, I think, I always think about, like, if I approached my mom and I was like, oh, mom, did you see the latest from the purple team? She would have, like, no clue what I was talking about. So I do think we have to explain what that is.
Yeah, for sure. So the Purple Team focused on kind of the nexus of social media and extremism and these kind of gray area topics that add the color to kind of just the facts part of the broader investigation. So other teams were like responsible for laying out things like X number of Proud Boys entered the Capitol at X time of day. And this is what they said in their, you know, DOJ court docs about their motivation for being there. And our team, which had kind of a mix of extremism experts, investigative counsel, some really talented professional staff members. Ultimately, we worked together to kind of answer those questions, contextualizing those kind of just the fact statements that other teams were making. So we'd be asking questions like, okay, so what's their real motivation? Because as we know, extremists lie. Or, okay, well, the FBI knew this. So how and why did they fumble the bag so hard? Or, okay, like, why was this person posting on social media in the lead up, or what were they posting on social media in the lead up to January 6th? And what policy, platform policies enabled this person to kind of be bombarded by the Civil War and apocalyptic-esque rhetoric that they were seeing. So really all of these kind of context-heavy analytical questions and nuance, that was our role to bring that to the table.
It was it ended up being kind of shocking, the scope that the Purple Team was asked to undertake. It was, I think it ended up being 7 or 8 employees total, like as a pretty small team, and we were tasked with doing, as Megan said, everything from covering domestic extremism broadly to social media policies and content moderation to federal failures and the response of the FBI and law enforcement to January 6th. So Megan and I focus specifically on just going out there and doing archival work and collecting a ton of data, social media data, to try to do basically fill, like, provide some information, provide some data for answering essentially all of those questions. But, like, at the end of the day, like, it was a pretty shocking amount of tasks and scope that the Purple Team was asked to handle.
Yeah, that sounds like really easy, like really simple, easy questions to answer. What was that experience like? I think I talked to the committee or various people on the committee maybe 3 or 4 times, but I imagine actually working as part of the committee was a pretty unique experience. Am I correct in thinking that? Especially, you know, when they're coming to you and being like, so, the intelligence community, what about that? Because these are kind of the big, at least the way I see it, like the big smoking gun questions left at the end of, you know, as the smoke clears on January 6th, it's, I think, a lot of the stuff that lingers in people's minds even today.
Yeah, I mean, I think this was my first time working for the government in any capacity, and it was a pretty wild first exposure to the inner workings of a legislative body.
The swamp, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, the January 6th committee is certainly no sort of like traditional government apparatus. Like, it was given a ton of autonomy and had a particularly unique relationship with the members of Congress because it was a bipartisan investigative committee. I mean, I think overall what I hope Megan would agree with me on is that, like, she and I were given kind of a lot of leeway to go out and do the kind of investigative work that we wanted to do. So, you know, we spent months just straight up collecting open source social media data and just seeing what came of it. I spent, like, you know, a couple months just finding YouTube data and, like, going into the archives of the .win websites that were posted online and, you know, doing that kind of thing and just seeing what we could find from it. But the sort of flip side is that, like I mentioned, like, we were asked to do a lot. We were asked to basically provide connective tissue for literally every single topic within the possible space of investigation for January 6th. So it was at times incredibly high pressure. I know Megan in particular spent a lot of late nights. I spent few less late nights, but still too many for my taste. And yeah, I mean, it was a lot of work. And there were some very, very tight turnarounds that I think have been covered in the media pretty extensively. There was some like, hey, you're going to do this. And then a week before the deadline, oh, just kidding, you're going to do this.
Mm. Yeah. And I think, like Alex, I technically had some experience working for the government, if you consider one semester of interning on Capitol Hill.
Oh,
in the year 2013.
Compromised.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And so beyond that, I didn't really know what to expect. And going into it, I think in all of our various roles that we've had throughout our careers, and this includes you as well, Jared, I think one of our goals, at least, is to get policymakers to listen, or just to hear us, make them aware of the reality on the ground, so to speak.
Right.
And
yeah.
I think this experience was so interesting because even though a good chunk of our work didn't necessarily make it into the hearings or didn't make it into the final report, which is fine, that's not really our place to say whether or not it belonged there. That's up to the members. We still had a chance to brief members on, you know, these really tough topics that they didn't really know about beforehand. And seeing their faces sometimes when we'd be talking to members and they were like, I had no idea. And it's like, yeah, of course, this is not your remit. And we wouldn't expect you to know that, but thank you so much for listening. Like, we had these opportunities to brief really powerful people who can affect policy and actually affect change, as corny as that sounds. And even, you know, especially in the lead up to the hearings where we were preparing materials for the, you know, extremism hearing that happened in mid-July. And we were like, okay, millions of people are going to see what we put together. So this is big. This is a big deal. And I think that was just operating at that scale was unlike anything I've ever done before.
Yeah.
Our work just doesn't get that many eyeballs on it. So I would say that's probably, yeah, the coolest part of the job. I don't really want to get into the negative sides,
yeah,
but that's
right.
Definitely the
it gets to exactly what you were saying, though, Megan, is I feel like all of us are a little bit of old heads in this space, like, to some various degrees. And I know, like, well, old heads in the context of internet stuff anyway. And I feel like the early part of my career was just like trying to get people to listen. And the idea that like powerful people that can actually write laws and shape change were exposed to this stuff and took it seriously and weren't just like, man, that's internet things. That's not real life. You know, I think it's a big silver lining. I was reading what you two, along with Dean Jackson, wrote for Just Security and Tech Policy Press. And, you know, you wrote that, you sort of hinted at this earlier, but you wrote that in this hundreds of pages long report that the Select Committee published, there you felt there were still important context left on the cutting room floor. In the opening of the essay, you know, kind of point to the focus on Trump's actions and sort of his activity during January 6th, and sort of seem to nudge at the idea that, you know, the final report maybe left some things out that would have helped explain the bigger picture. Am I getting the like correct read on that? Is that sort of the sentiment that you guys were putting down, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair characterization. You know, as Megan and I have said in the essay and you know previously, the decisions that the members of Congress made in the report are theirs, and they have justifications for those. There's good reasons to focus narrowly. And now that the committee is done and we are back to our jobs as analysts, it is our job now to fill in the gaps and to show like, hey, there's this, you know, the specific aspect of the report that the report covered was, you could think of like the tip of the spear, and then there's this entire additional part of the spear that we need to talk about as well to actually address, you know, the root issues and risks being posed to democracy. So ultimately, I think that's a very fair characterization. Megan, do you want to?
Sure. So to be clear, I think the extremism chapter in the report is great. And I know maybe I'm biased.
Yeah, I thought it was very good. Mm-hmm. I will say
100%.
That.
And I mean, obviously, there's part of me that's biased because I know those responsible for it. And I genuinely like them as people. But I think they did a really respectable job of laying out just the facts. And writing congressional style reports is an entirely different skill set than I have, or not speak for you, Alex, but probably that you have either. We have a different writing style. This is something that was totally out of our wheelhouse. So I really respect the job that they did. And I think they told a really compelling story. And I think it met the expectations, or even exceeded the expectations, for a congressional output meant for public consumption. And I think the report writers did exactly what they were supposed to do, that said, within the confines of what they were asked to do. And the very, you know, by the virtue of that, there's going to be stuff left on the cutting room floor. And I think for us, and because obviously, Jared, you're not the first person to ask us this question at any point in the past year while we've been working on the committee. And I think, I don't mean, this is going to sound snarky, but I think ultimately my go-to answer is like white supremacy, anti-government sentiment, all of these things that played a role in mobilizing people to the Capitol on January 6th. They didn't start when Trump was elected president. They didn't start during, you know, Trump's election campaign. Yeah. These are not new issues. And so I think assigning the entirety of the blame to Trump is, you know, he deserves, obviously, he's the one who told people to be there for sure.
Couldn't happen to a worse.
No, 100%. And I think it was Ryan Riley when he was popping off on MSNBC one day after the report came out about kind of the lack of, you know, certain things that were missing from the report in his opinion. And he said, you know, people can walk and chew gum at the same time, like referring to the American people. And I think that's kind of where we're at here, is we're like, okay, the report laid out the facts. Now let's provide people with the extra detail, because the threat goes far beyond Trump. The threat has not gone away. And whether or not Trump is the nominee in 2024, that's not going to change the nature of the threat or the severity of the threat. The threat's still there. So I think that's really why we're doing kind of the podcast circuit, writing articles, as we're just filling in these analytical blanks and in the hopes that people will listen and hopefully it'll affect policy in a positive way.
Yeah, we'll get to some of those blanks in a second, but I did want to ask what you guys perceived as maybe, because I don't want to ask you to put anyone on blast or anything, but like perceived, I guess, gaps, to borrow your word. I'm curious if that was something that was raised during the writing of the report, or sort of how those decisions were made. I mean, I guess ultimately the decisions fall on the members and what they would like to see in the report. But I'm curious how that sort of, you know, how the sausage is made in that sense. I don't know if that's something you can talk about, but I did want to ask.
I mean, I think the thing that is safe to talk about, and, you know, as we've been saying, like, the decisions were not ours, and I think there were good justifications for what was cut and what was included. But the thing that we can say is that, like, Megan and I and the rest of the Purple team wrote a lot of pages of analysis on a lot of topics that was not included in the final report. And there were discussions about what to include. And those discussions lasted for a very long time. And I think a lot of those discussions have been covered at various points in the media. We are ultimately, like, I was a consultant and Megan was an investigator. Neither of us had sort of decision-making capabilities. So, there were a lot of discussions that we simply weren't privy to or weren't included in. But ultimately, like, we tried our best and did it and wrote a ton of analysis.
Cool. Yeah. I did want to ask, not to, you know, fault anybody here. In my conversations that I did have with various investigators, I got the sense that there was just an obscene amount of information in the mix. And there's just, I mean, I guess they could publish like an encyclopedia set on this at some later date for the real heads, the real collectors. But, you know, I did want to get into some of these perceived gaps, like these information gaps or explanation gaps, and try to explore some of those for a little bit. I don't think it'll surprise either of you that I've argued for a long time, one may even say since January 7th, 2021, that the Capitol riot wouldn't have been possible the way that it happened without the internet. And I also wouldn't be surprised if both of you agreed with that. That said, were there any spaces or parts of the investigation where you expected social media to, like, get into the mix, but maybe it didn't, or maybe it played a role that was a little different than people may assume that it did?
Well, because it's kind of an open-ended question, I guess you kind of just built the soapbox for us, so allow us to step onto that. I think the key thing that Alex and I were yelling about for the past year, not literally yelling, mostly typing in all caps in a Microsoft Teams chat, but we kept referencing the title of an essay that Alex wrote in the CTC Sentinel, I guess in 2021, was it, Alex, called "The Threat is the Network." And ultimately, that was kind of all of the evidence that we gathered, whether it was qualitative examination of various platforms. And I mean, we looked at a lot of platforms, or if we were looking at the ways that folks were interacting with each other online, offline, et cetera, the way that membership of groups shifted over time. I mean, it all boils down to the threat is the network. And so I think it's the committee, and for good reason, focused a lot on the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers. And I think something that probably justifiably fell outside the confines of the report is an explanation of kind of the post-organizational domestic extremist landscape that we're seeing now that the far right is operating within. And I think that's why, we have some articles that we're planning on writing, and that's why we're obviously here today, is to wax poetic about kind of this realistic picture of far right extremism in the US and how it's no longer one that really relies exclusively on groups, but rather, how it structures itself as this amorphous, ever-changing kind of spiderweb structure versus.
Because there's still the question, like, of course, the committee would want to answer, what were the Oath Keepers doing? What were the Proud Boys doing? These are organized groups that in different capacities have, have an inclination towards troublemaking, I would say. But then there's also the question of, like, how did the boat salesman from Florida and, like, the pre-K teacher from Arkansas, I'm just making this shit up off my head. I'm sure if I did a smidge more work, I could have pulled some real examples. How did ordinary people wind up, like, next to these groups, charging in, throwing chairs in the Capitol, breaking windows, that sort of thing? Alex, when Megan referenced that idea that, the threat is the network, since you're the one who wrote the piece, can you explain that concept a little bit more for, the average listener?
Yeah. So the entire concept of the phrase "the threat is the network" is this idea that far right extremism, in particular, transnationally and domestically in the United States, has moved into this phase where named organizations, so like think like the Oath Keepers, Adam Waffen Division, Warrior Creek Division, the Proud Boys, etc. The boundaries of those specific name groups don't mean as much as they did in the late 20th century, early 20th century, etc. If you think back to like, if you know anything about like white supremacist activism in, let's say, 1960s, 1970s, it was very much organized around specific named entities. So like the Order or the Covenant Sword and the Arm of the Lord. There were interactions between these groups, but for the most part, you were a member of one of those groups, and that is all you were. These days, and my argument is that, and Megan's is too, is that in large part due to the influence of the internet, these days the boundaries between those entities is increasingly irrelevant, because what we're seeing is that people are like basically, you know, flowing between different groups really, really easily. We're seeing huge audiences of people who are radicalized and mobilized to a point where we would call them a domestic extremist without having any sort of affiliation at all. And we're seeing in increasing frequencies actual alliances between named groups where normally we would see competition. So like this is actually, this last point is something that did come through in the final January 6th report. You saw the moment where the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers actually sort of struck a coalition, like a formal coalition.
Yeah, because normally they don't like each other.
Right. They don't, they absolutely hate each other. And if you know anything about them, like, it you would think that they would never work together in 100 years. Like it's the Oath Keepers are a group that call themselves a militia, and the Proud Boys are basically like a neo-fascist street fighting, you know, toxic masculinity, you know, group that views itself as foot soldiers of Trump. Like those two things shouldn't mix, and they wouldn't have mixed in the 1990s. But what we're seeing is that there's this increasing movement within the far right extremist space to be organized around what Brian Hughes and Cynthia Miller Idris call mobilizing concepts. This idea that narratives are becoming more important than organizations altogether. And this is where you see these like swarm dynamics come into play. This is where you see like the mass mobilization phenomenon that is most, you know, represented by like movements like QAnon come to play. And so you see this basically like miasma of all these extremists organizing together, interacting with one another, and then mobilizing for a common goal.
So there were a few things in the essay that you wrote that were particularly interesting to me, and some of them had to do with this idea that, you know, I think a lot of people have in popular sentiment, which is that the reason Facebook or Twitter or whatever social media platform doesn't act on extremism or doesn't, you know, make this decision or another is because they're all driven by this profit motive. And I certainly think that's part of the, you know, motivations in play here. But some of what you wrote in this essay for Just Security and Tech Policy Press kind of gets at political motivations for these decisions being made as well, which I think is almost more interesting. And I wanted to ask about that in the context of the Twitter files. A quick summation, it's a set of internal documents, emails, communications that Elon Musk has given to a select few reporters that he knows will write about the unending wokeness inside Twitter or whatever. And they kind of, you know, show what communications were like at different points inside Twitter, at least, you know, as employees were debating whether Trump actually violated policies and a ban was justified or not, and those sort of things. The essay you wrote says, platforms did not hold Trump to a higher standard by removing his account after January 6. Rather, for years, they wrote rules to avoid holding him and his supporters accountable. It took an attempted coup d'etat for them to change course. And I imagine that working in the committee and getting sort of a front row look at this, you kind of look at the Twitter files a little differently. I know I was looking at them and I thought, okay, well, this is like inherently interesting, but this also like does not show what Matt Taibbi and Barry Weiss and all of them think that it shows. Alex, what is your hot take? The Twitter files, scoop of the century, the next Julian Assange WikiLeaks situation?
Yeah, what I find most hilarious about the Twitter files is they show exactly the opposite of what Matthew Taibbi and Barry Weiss think it shows, and apparently Elon Musk think it shows. Like when you read just the files, like the internal communications that were leaked or that Elon allowed to be leaked, essentially, what you see is basically like a bunch of content moderators and trust and safety professionals trying to do the best they can with the strictures that they are working under. Things like the Biden campaign sending, you know, examples of terms of service violations to Twitter trust and safety, like that is something that like literally every company under the sun handles, is like basically direct reports from trusted people in their orbit. Like there's probably an email chain at like half the tech companies in the United States that say Alex Newhouse just sent X piece of content to you, like you should take it down. Like there's nothing special or like dangerous there. That's just how trust and safety works, because trust and safety is inherently hard to do. It's, you have to rely on people who are out there on the front lines. In our investigations on the committee though, what we found and what's public in the docs is that like trust and safety is also pretty intrinsically reactive in most cases. There are a lot of headwinds, both politically and institutionally, that put pressure on these types of organizations within companies to basically err on the side of doing nothing. Mm. They want to keep things going in the same way that they have always been going. So there's this sort of intrinsic inertia towards taking what could be seen as like very public action against especially like public individuals like Donald Trump. And the reasons for that are varied, but as we wrote in Just Security, at least part of it is definitely this fear of political reprisal. And I think there's a lot of really interesting and complex discussions that should be had around that. Like one of the big ones that I talk about in my other job, my non-government job, is there is this constant war between the sort of stated desire on the social platform's part of wanting to protect freedom of speech, broadly construed, and then the actual mechanical desire of wanting to foster healthy communities and healthy interactions. And more often than not, those two things are at odds with one another. And yet, because they state that they are committed to freedom of speech, they end up in these binds in which, you know, they have to err on the side of caution, err on the side of non-movement, non-action, if they are going to avoid any sort of backlash.
It's like the magic conch in SpongeBob where they pull the string and it just says,
"What do we need to do to get out of the kelp forest?"
"Nothing.
The shell has spoken."
Exactly.
That's how they get out of binds, apparently.
And can I add something to that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I think it's also worth noting that what the committee found as a result of, you know, like I said, the depositions, the various productions that were supplied as a result of subpoenas, and the conclusions that the team drew that you read about in the essay that we authored with Dean Jackson, is ultimately, it just bolstered what other entities have already said. Like Media Matters has done studies on this. ISD and Politico did a study on this. Conservative censorship is not a thing, not on these platforms, not in the way that people say it is. And so I think it's important, obviously, that a government investigation yielded the same results as non-government entities. And so now we can kind of say, like, we have a ton of evidence that proves that the conclusions that people are drawing from the Twitter files are just straight up incorrect. And I'm excited that there's just, you know, more evidence that points to the fact that this is easily refutable.
Yeah. Jared, do you remember in 2016 or 2017 after the election when Alex Stamos stepped down from trust and safety at Facebook?
Yeah, I think so.
One of the things that he put on blast is that he felt like the C-suite was doing this exact thing.
I remember this now.
On.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like he felt basically hamstrung from taking any sort of meaningful action against what he saw was clearly election meddling and disinformation campaigns. And, you know, Alex Stamos is no bleeding heart leftist. Like he's pretty moderate dude who was just trying to do his job on election integrity and trust and safety of Facebook and got basically stonewalled by C-suites for at least he alleged these same types of motivations. So it's something that's, it's been a, you know, this has been a years long problem. And what we found in the committee is that like in the lead up to January 6th, these problems basically reared their ugly head in the worst possible way.
So I was reading a critique from John Lewis at George Washington's University's program on extremism, because apparently Just Security is the only publication that I read this week. And I wanted to ask you guys about it, get your take on it. You know, John looked at this report, it's hundreds of pages, and sort of faulted it for leaving two big questions unanswered. You know, one of those questions was the scope of law enforcement and intelligence failures. The other one was what concrete steps could have been taken to combat those failures and the rising threat of domestic extremism. And, you know, I want to get your take on whether you think that's a fair criticism of the report. But at least from where I sit, you know, it's definitely, I wish there would have been clearer answers to that stuff in the report. But I think it kind of speaks to a broader shortcoming in extremism research overall. And we can talk about that in a second. But first, I wanted to get your take on, you know, that line of critique. Like, did the end result, do you think it, you know, left some things unanswered that should have been answered or could have been answered?
I'm trying to think about the way to answer this while like trying to narrow how many people I piss off with my answer. I think, like I said, I think the extremism chapter was very good and very well done. And I think they did exactly what they could have done for a congressional report from that was put together by a bipartisan committee. That said, I'm going to get some angry texts about this. I think the legislative recommendations were a cop-out. I think John's criticisms were pretty fair. And I think if, and granted there were time constraints, right? There was, like you said, Jared, earlier, we were doing a lot. There's a lot of information. We had a big staff trying to cover every single facet of what happened basically in the year of 2021 or 2020 leading up to January 6th, 2021. And so it did just feel like the legislative recommendations were a bit of an afterthought, and especially as they relate to extremism. And I can pontificate a little bit about why I think the extremism ones, or one in particular, was insufficient. And I think that has a lot to do with just political discomfort about the truths of who was at January 6th and who did violence on January 6th.
What do you mean? Like which policy recommendation are you referring to?
Just the one that was talking about kind of how we address white supremacy and it's, or, you know, and racism and just violent extremism.
Is that the one where it's like, we have to confront all extremism?
Yeah. Like that, and it was like, that one, we need an informed citizenry. And it's like, no, for sure.
Yes. 100%
yes. Agreed, man.
And,
but like,
Right.
Exactly. And I think ultimately the majority of the people who showed up on January 6th which is fine, you know, observe your First Amendment rights, go off. But the people who did violence on January 6th, the majority of them were not Oath Keepers. They were not Proud Boys. They were not militia members. It was just average
undercover Antifa.
Bingo. And the
Nailed
FBI.
It.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yes. So glad that's on record.
Operation Paperclip.
Yeah. I can imagine the headlines now.
MK Ultra activated.
Exactly.
Exactly. So I think, and that's an uncomfortable truth to reconcile with, right? Is like average Americans were down to show up and kill congressmen and disrupt a key facet of American democracy. That's nuts when you think about it. And if the members of Congress had left, you know, and if Mike Pence had left, you know, we would have been in a constitutional crisis, and that's nuts. And I think it's an uncomfortable truth to reconcile with, like I said, that, yeah, Donald Trump gave these folks a time and a place, a belief that they could affect change if they showed up, and his endorsement of their attendance with that December 19th tweet. But a lot of these folks, they weren't any Oath Keepers and Proud Boys. Like I said, they were just MAGA. They were just Trump supporters. And
they still did it. Trump can say all of that.
Yeah.
But they still have agency. I feel like a lot of discourse around this stuff subtracts agency from those people.
Right. For sure.
They still had to look at it and be like, yep. You know, it's...
Yes.
I think it can be kind of comforting for some people to think of those folks as like mindless drones that were injected with some kind of message. And I think, you know, echo chamber effects and what kind of media and what kind of people you surround yourself with have a role in that. But at the end of the day, people... You know, these are grown-ups. They can make their decisions. They can chart their life.
Yes. And a lot of the folks who were charged with crimes related to activities on January 6th have taken that route where they're like, well, Trump told me to be there. So of course I'm going to be there. I'll be wild, et cetera. And there's a distinct possibility that's true, but there's also a distinct possibility that they're trying to get lighter sentences. Like,
yeah.
So I think.
Yeah. Cause they know the prosecutors, like at least the ones on the Hill are like, ooh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's compelling,
that.
Right? That's compelling to be like the president of the United States asked me to do a coup. Like, that's insane. And so, like, that's spicy stuff. And in some cases that might have been true, but in others, yeah, I think folks are passing off their agency and placing blame on someone who absolutely encouraged them to be there, but didn't drag them there by their hair.
So you felt that maybe some of the recommendations didn't really hit that element of it?
For sure. I think, like I said, you know, we can absolutely ask and support legislation that will lead to a more informed citizenry. For sure. We love media literacy here. We love critical thinking here. But to absolve the broader GOP and conservative media, and that was mainstream conservative media too. It wasn't just, you know, the Donald.win or whatever. Like, everyone was using this revolutionary, apocalyptic, if Joe Biden becomes president, this is the end of America as we know it rhetoric. That was across the board.
Yeah.
And we're not holding people accountable for it.
Yeah. I think one of the most uncomfortable, you know, phenomena that happened on January 6th that we desperately need to confront, but are certainly haven't yet, is the fact that, like, a bunch of people's grandparents were talking about hanging Mike Pence in the streets, like in Facebook groups in the weeks leading up, and on YouTube comments and that kind of thing. Like, literally, like, 80-year-old people who are mostly just knitting, and yeah, they're like knitting in their rocking chairs, are talking about taking guns and like doing a day of the rope in DC. Like, that's insane. Like, that is absolutely untenable for the functioning of American democracy. And, like, you know, ultimately, like, the January 6th report, like, the metaphor that you can think of is, like, the writers were trying to throw an elephant through a basketball hoop a mile away. Like, that is the balancing act that they were trying to run here. And it's the product of what it was. It's the product of it being a pretty uniquely bipartisan investigative committee. But, like, ultimately, at the end of the day, the policy recommendations, you know, me analyzing it as an outside observer now, like, they're not enough to actually address, like, the root threats to American democracy. We need to have massive investment in figuring out how the hell to stop your like, all of these networks of like, everyone from a 14-year-old going into high school up in, including, like, 85-year-old grandparents from talking in these sorts of ways and engaging in these, like, fantasies about, you know, mobilizing the violence against political opponents.
Yeah, when I was reading John's piece, I also, you know, started to think that I think his criticism of the, you know, policy proposals in the report could also be, you know, more broadly applied to this whole research field anyway. You know, there's interventions people propose, you know, people will propose moderating online platforms, and all of those are good and great, but they don't really attack the core heart of the problem. Like, even myself, like, gun to my head, I feel like if they were like, what do you do? How do you solve extremism? I would have muttered something like, I don't know, you would improve society somewhat and, you know, enforce social stigmas against bad behavior or something. And that's not to erase the work that, you know, people at Parallel at American University are trying to do, or, you know, all the people out there trying to answer those questions. But there isn't really a universally agreed upon approach to fixing this problem. And I wonder, like, how much can we really attribute this to the authors of the report, and how much of it is just kind of a systemic problem in extremism research more broadly? I'd be curious to hear both of your takes on that as people who are, you know, working in this field along with me. If you have different takes, same takes, that sort of thing. What do you think, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, one of the big problems is that, like, even in these sort of generally left-leaning extremism study space, we can't agree for 2 seconds on how to actually have a proactive impact on mitigating extremism. Like, CVE and PVE are such contentious fields that have a lot of, frankly, junk science behind them, and it's really, really hard to come to any sort of understanding about how to make a meaningful impact on root causes. But at the same time, there are things that we know do work on, like, helping antisocial behavior in general. Like, you know, encouraging people to form real world social connections is, like, generally a net positive. Like, it's a net positive on all sorts of different social ills and threats to civil society. And like, making huge investments in doing things like positive behavior incentives, that's something that is, like, as far as I've seen in the research, like there's no real risk in doing that. There's only upside, and it's just sort of like their political wins against it. You know, I do a lot of work with tech companies and video game companies these days, and they're in the absolute nascent stages of considering things like positive content moderation instead of just negative, like instead of just disciplinary, like actually putting in place systems that encourage positive social connections and sort of pro-social behaviors. And like, this is the year, this is 2023 now, like we should not just now be considering in, you know, incentivizing those kinds of behaviors, but it's the nature of the thing. So I think it's like, I generally feel a little bit mixed, where like there certainly is a lot of disagreement on how exactly to mitigate and prevent extremism, but like there are also some very clear ways to just increase investment and increase engagement. Megan, do you have any other thoughts?
Yeah, I think this is definitively not, this does not fall on the shoulders of the report writers at all. I think this is a combination. The resulting report and the legislative recommendations were that, obviously, as we've discussed, are, in our humble opinion, lacking. I think it's the result of time constraints, bandwidth constraints on the committee, and also, like I said, like political expediency. What's politically comfortable is when you're working as part of a bipartisan committee that wants the American people to read this report, take away certain things from it, and not get mad about it. And so, of course, you're trying to make things as palatable as possible. So I empathize with those who had to come up with the legislative recommendations. And so I think instead of maybe framing this as like, oh, they weren't enough, I think we can also frame it as, okay, here's some very basic building blocks for us to comment on and build upon and use the evidence that the committee put forth in the report and in the hearings to keep working with policymakers. And because now they're paying attention, right? So we might as well take advantage of this opportunity and keep yelling at them about what we think they should do.
Hot take, rapid fire. Gaming, good or bad, Alex?
Oh, God. gaming can be one of the best things in the world. Gaming can also be one of the worst things in the world. I'll leave it there.
Megan, James Cameron's movie career, the new Avatar movie specifically. Have you seen it? What did you think? Do you like the Avatar franchise?
I think I don't at all. I think that's a fair fair characterization of my feelings. And I think the SNL skit about using papyrus as the Avatar font, I think that's probably what I agree with most about any takes about the Avatar franchise.
Reunion tours from old emo bands. Alex, are these a good thing or a cynical ploy to capitalize on my nostalgia?
Extremely good thing. Let's go. Tom DeLonge back on Blink-182. I'm here for it. Let's do a Sum 41 reunion tour. Are they still around? I don't even know. Does someone, who knows? Anyways, I'm here for it all.
Hippies that are really into quartz crystals, horoscopes, and that sort of thing. Net positive or net negative on society, Megan?
Let the girlies enjoy things. Let the girls, gays, and days have their hobbies and interests.
Okay, last one is more on topic. What's something about the committee that the public might not know, but you thought was interesting?
I think considering a lot of the coverage justifiably focused on the various leaks that were coming out and kind of the discord within the committee and disagreements about what would end up in the hearings and what would end up in the report, frustration with the focus on Trump. I think that said, everyone was really motivated by the mission. People worked really freaking hard. People worked together. People gave a shit and genuinely cared about making a difference. And I think that kind of got lost in the drama sometimes that was being, you know, put out into the ether. And I think it's also worth noting that even though there was this focus on Trump, the members that we spoke to were incredibly receptive to what we had to say about social media and extremism. They cared. They asked follow-up questions. They asked us to do follow-up projects. They gave a shit. And that's awesome. Can I say gave a shit on this?
Yeah. You can say shit, balls, whatever.
That's, wow, I feel empowered. So yeah, they gave a shit. And I think while being a Fed was not a good fit for me in the long term, and I'm excited to be moving on from that phase of my life, I did feel better about our elected officials after working with them in kind of like one-on-one or small teams environments. And I was like, oh, you guys actually care a little bit about this. That's awesome. Some members more than others, but I felt inspired by that.
Yeah. And to corroborate that, I think there's a tendency among left-leaning folks, including myself before I worked on the committee, to ascribe the dysfunction of the government generally to specific to all of the individuals who compose it. And one of the things that was most interesting to me is that, like Megan was saying, a lot of the members of Congress really are incredibly sharp and get this stuff. Like, we spent quite a lot of time presenting the concept of post-organizational extremism and you know, that being supercharged by the internet to members of Congress, who some of them, you know, are in their 70s and you wouldn't expect to be as with it as they were, but they all got it and they were all incredibly receptive. And you know, I think I still have quite a bit of cynicism towards the functioning of government for a variety of reasons, but it was actually pretty encouraging to see, like, oh yeah, there are a lot of members of Congress who work really goddamn hard and know their shit, which was fascinating and encouraging.
All right, I've been talking with Alex Newhouse, Megan Conroy. This is Posting Through It. There's one last question I have to ask you both. What's your favorite thing on the internet right now? Megan, let's start with you.
Okay, of course it's going to be about January 6th, but there's an illustrator. His name is Brian Michael Weaver, and he took months to draw an accurate illustration of the insurrection in the style of Where's Waldo? And it's on the internet. It's on his homepage. I can send you the link. And it's accurate based on who was there. So, like, all the folks who were arrested or, you know, have been obviously indicted or anything, and what weapons or flags they were carrying. It's incredible. And they're also going to turn it into a puzzle. So I can't wait to buy the puzzle.
Yeah, send me a link to that. I'll put it in the description.
Will do.
Alex, what say you? What is the best thing online right now?
So ever since I mostly quit Twitter, I found myself feeling more sincere and authentic. And so mine is actually going to be like a seriously positive thing. And that's that Damar Hamlin, who's the safety of the Buffalo Bills, who collapsed on the field last week. He, before he went into the NFL, he started a very small charity to do a toy drive at a children's hospital near where he lived. And it had raised like a couple thousand dollars before he collapsed. And since then, the NFL subreddit and like all of these different internet communities have like rallied around it to a really shocking extent. And now I've raised, I think, close to $8 million for his, wow, for his tiny charity. It's like one of those things. It's like network effects can be cool and can be good. They rarely are, but in this case, it was actually genuinely an awesome and inspiring thing to see.
I guess you could say the network is the treat.
There you go. Case. Nailed it.
Oh,
yeah.
Now that I've embarrassed myself, let's close this thing out. Alex, Megan, thanks so much for joining this week.
Thanks, Jared. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. This has been great. It's time I got back, and I don't even know how I got off the track.